Yeah, thank you for inviting me and organizing this symposium. I'm going to try to give you my perspective, not only as a Californian in that sort of hellscape that was described in terms of the drought, but just more broadly in terms of dealing with extremes in agriculture. And like Oscar said at the beginning, the question on the table is what we know sort of that investments in adaptation should reduce the impacts or the risks associated with climate change. In theory, we know that, and in practice, it becomes a matter of what do we actually invest in, what do we actually try to do. And so I've been thinking about that question in the context of extreme heat in a few different settings. One is in the U.S., in particular the Midwest. The picture in the background there is a picture of 2012 in the U.S. And then also in the context of Australia, I spent about half a year in Australia with a group there thinking about adaptation to extreme heat in the cereal systems of Australia. And then we've also been working in a few other places like India, but I'm going to give two examples today, basically, one from Australia, one from the U.S. I was thinking of doing the first half in my Australian accent and the second half in my American accent, but 6 months wasn't good enough to perfect my Australian accent, so I'm not going to embarrass myself. But if you want to hear a nice Australian accent, Mark Howden's going to be giving a talk tomorrow morning. He's got a beautiful accent. Okay. Extreme heat. So what is extreme heat? I think this is a kind of an obvious thing, but also kind of a sticking point in a lot of conversations, in that people are talking about very different things, and it can sort of cause a lot of confusion. So in some sense, you know, extreme heat is kind of like, you know it when you see it. It's really hot, and people are uncomfortable. But what does it really mean? Well, as far as I can tell, there's at least three kind of working definitions out there, although I don't know if, you know, they've been... Benjamin was describing the different definitions of drought that are out there. Like, we have meteorological drought, we have hydrological drought, we have agricultural drought, probably a few other flavors of drought as well that people have sort of recognized and tackled. We don't have a similar thing going on with heat, but I'm gonna give a quick attempt here. So one way to define heat is just based on historical probability. So something that used to not happen a lot, we call an extreme. And as it happens increasingly, we probably still call it extreme until we sort of update our priors on how likely that event is, and then maybe we say it's not so extreme anymore. So this is just a summary figure. Lots of summary figures have been made like this, where you've got this historical distribution, you shift it to the right, and therefore you have all sorts of additional probabilities of these events in red that you didn't have before. A lot of people confuse this with increase in variability. You don't need an increase in variability to get an increase in the occurrence of historical extremes. You just shift the distribution, and there you go. You can also change the distribution shape, but it's not really required. So that's one easy definition of extreme. You just define like the 95 percentile of historical temperatures, and you say how frequent are those, and that's one way. Another way is, and this is common in sort of the, I would say, econometric community, or the people that go and take data sets and try to analyze the relationships between temperatures and outcomes, including agricultural outcomes. You'll often find that there is sort of kinks in those relationships where things really start to go downhill. This is a plot showing analysis of U.S. corn and soybean yields, looking at hourly temperature exposures and the response of different yields, and you can see both corn and soybean tend to really decline in terms of productivity as you get above about 29 degrees Celsius. So up until that point, this shows you different ways of estimating the response curve with different flexibilities, but you can see that heat is actually not such a bad thing until you get to temperatures about 29 degrees, and then it becomes really bad. So extreme heat, when you hear often people talk about extreme degree days or extreme heat, it's often in this context of where do things empirically seem to fall apart, and it will depend on where you are, what crop you're looking at, or what outcome you're looking at. But I would say that maybe typically when you see something like extreme degree days, they're talking about a 30 degree threshold. At the same time, I think in the crop community and the agronomic community in particular, often we're thinking about specific impacts of heat. In other words, what we know in terms of when crops are directly damaged by temperature. So when temperature really starts to induce things like sterility of reproductive organs. And this is an example from my colleagues in Australia looking at sorghum, where they've exposed what was otherwise a normal sorghum plant to a high temperature treatment, and you can see a lot of the grains fail to set. So this looks much worse. Those tend to be at higher temperatures. So for sorghum, even well, depends on the variety. So this is just showing you kind of typical curves for different groups of varieties. Some are quite sensitive, and you'll see this decline in grain set at something like 32, 33 degrees. A lot of varieties, and this maize would be similar, won't see really obvious declines until you get to about 35 or 36 degrees Celsius. So quite a bit above what we were calling extreme heat in the previous slide based on impacts. But heat stress to crop physiologists generally means something very specific. And when they talk about extreme heat, in their minds, they're talking about things like 34, 35, 36 degrees Celsius. Okay, so, and by any measure, maybe this is not even worth pointing out, but hopefully it's obvious that because we're warming everywhere, all seasons, as was said, we're increasing all these measures of extremes, some more quickly than others. This is just a study we did looking at the grain-producing areas and seasons around the world. These very high sort of heat stress temperatures, how fast is exposure to those going up? And you can see historically there's been some increase, particularly in wheat systems, but that the historical rates of these exposures are not terribly high. So this is kind of a weighted average of historically what fraction of the time does a crop growing in a region get exposed to a certain number of days above these critical temperatures. But over time, you can see that it's increased, and then into the future, it increases quite a bit, depending on two different thresholds. Obviously, the lower the threshold, the more common, more frequent you'll pass it. And you can see doubling, tripling, even of these extremes. If I were to plot this instead in terms of degree days above 30, or if I were to plot this in terms of days above some 95th percentile historically, they would all be going up. So defining extreme heat isn't so important in terms of saying whether it's going up. It's going up by all these measures. But I think it is important in thinking about how to adapt to it. Okay, so when we think about temperature adaptation or high temperature adaptation, I find it useful to think about the different processes that are going on, because it's, as you all know, temperature affects just about every single thing that goes on in biology, right? So you've got changes in photosynthetic and respiration rates, which I'll call crop growth, changes in the development rates, how quickly these crops move through their life cycles. You've got water stress, and this is simply the fact, as was explained, that you have a very nonlinear increase in the water holding capacity of the atmosphere as temperature goes up. You've got direct damage of the crops, and this was like the heat stress I was referring to before, as it's typically defined by physiologists. And then you've got all the other biology that's affecting the plants, pests and diseases, which are also very sensitive to temperatures. Now, when you think about extreme heat, I think it's important to remember that these processes kick in at different temperatures. So, for example, my assessment is that the water stress effects become really increasingly important once you get above 30 degrees C. And that's empirically, I think, why we see it come out so prominently in these empirical analyses. It's a lot of water stress effects that are being reflected in the outcomes. On the other hand, as I said before, the direct damage from heat kicks in at higher temperatures, 35 and higher, or 34, depending on the crop. So as we think about options, it really, in my mind, depends on which of these processes are driving most of the impacts. If some of these processes, for example, if heat stress is only occurring in about 1 or 2% of the years, and it's going to increase to 4 or 5%, you can work on that, but it's not going to get you that far in terms of adaptation if, compared to that 5%, water stress is causing 25, 30% losses, right? So you want to think about which is the bigger source of impact, but also in terms of what are the possible kind of effective adaptations. So if you think, again, in my mind, some of these are going to be a lot easier than others. So if you think about options in general in two categories, one is like tolerance, where you kind of can withstand extreme heat, and the other being escape, which is that you just try to either finish up your season more quickly or avoid the peak of the season altogether, would be a different strategy. This would be more like an escape strategy or fight and flight, if you can think of it that way. And I think that depending on which process you're talking about, one of these options may make more sense than others. And what I'm going to argue today, or what I'll argue right now, I guess, is that for water stress, I think flight is as useful as anything. I don't think there's a whole lot that's been done, at least on the genetic side, that really greatly improves the sort of fight aspect. Or maybe to say that more clearly, anything that does improve in terms of being able to tolerate extreme heat as we know it, in terms of the major impacts of extreme heat is probably related to things like deeper rooting or setting maximum transpiration rates, things like that. And those things are, they're certainly useful when temperatures get high. I don't mean to imply that they're not. But in terms of the difference between, say, a future climate scenario and a current climate scenario, they're not going to be able to reduce. They're not going to be more effective in the future than they are now. They'd be plenty effective right now. I realize that's not totally clear. Hopefully it'll be clear when we're done. In terms of the flight, we're talking about things like avoiding the season altogether, as I said, and this would be like a double cropping option. So this is why we've been looking into double cropping quite a bit, and I'll explain that more in a second. All right, so the first example from Australia is really about this heat stress, the direct damage to grains. And one thing that was known by my colleagues there, so this is Graham Hammer, Scott Chapman, and several others, starting to think about heat stress, the first thing they do is they try to screen a lot of different varieties of sorghum to see how sensitive different varieties are. I've already shown you kind of a summary of the range. This shows you individual lines, and they're basically the amount of successful germination, or basically effective seed setting, as a function of temperature. So as you get to warmer temperatures, it goes down. For the very susceptible ones, it goes down very quickly, and for the tolerant ones, it goes down less quickly. So the question is, how effective will this be? And again, it depends on how important this was a mechanism of damage. But the clear thing here is that there is some genetic variability that exists, at least in sorghum. So what we did to look at this was we took an Apsom crop model, which is a very kind of well-established, well-tested model in these systems, and implemented things that can actually mimic the effects of heat stress on the crop, and then looked at how this plays out into the future, both with and without more adapted varieties. We did this for wheat as well, but I'm going to focus mainly on sorghum just for time. So one thing we see in terms of after we put this in the model and we play out the future scenarios, because temperatures are going up, if you look on the left here, this is the more sensitive varieties, and you can see that on average now, about 40% of these varieties, these varieties growing in the field, about 40% of the years that they're grown, they'll see significant amount of temperatures, enough to reduce their seed set by about 10%. You can see over here the more tolerant runs, that's down from 40% down to 5%. So it makes a big difference what you assume the current germplasm is. As you go forward, you can see that those losses become increasingly high. Now, this is not yield loss. This is just the frequency of losses above 10% for grain set. But that doesn't tell you what the average yield losses are. So I'm going to show you that here, which is just comparing if you had perfect sort of tolerance to high temperatures for seed set versus what you have now. Currently, the sensitive varieties are about 6% lower. Sorry. No, it's an 8%. Sorry. 8% lower, and the tolerant varieties are about 2% lower because of these heat stress effects. You can compare that, for example, to the impacts of drought, which we do by comparing simulations with and without water stress. And you, at least, not no water stress, but basically minimal water stress associated with the no drought environments. You can see that right now, heat stress, even in the more sensitive varieties, is much less important than drought stress. But you see moving forward that the importance of heat stress grows. It grows in absolute value, it also grows even more quickly relative to drought. Australia is one of these areas where we actually don't expect, at least in northeast Australia, we don't expect drought stress to get a lot worse. And this may seem maybe counterintuitive or contradictory to the previous speaker. And without going into all the details, I think the key difference here is when you think of it from a crop's perspective, you have to not only think about rainfall and not only think about humidity, and not only think about temperature and saturation pressure, but you need to think about carbon dioxide levels. And for these crops in arid systems, CO2 levels can really dramatically affect the water relations. Okay, so when we look at water stress from a crop's perspective, we really need to think about that. In Australia, the CO2 is outpacing physiologically the humidity and temperature changes enough in this region that for sorghum you see a decline in the drought exposure. Okay, so what we conclude here is that, you know, because there is a lot of genetic variability and because it seems to be increasingly important as a source of reducing impact, so you can see here the impact would be an additional 10% loss, whereas here it's only an additional 3% loss, that this represents sort of a pretty effective opportunity for efforts to adapt. Okay, so now we'll turn to maize in the U.S. And I should maybe not go on tangents because how much time do I have left? 10 minutes. Okay, maybe I will go on a tangent. So you might expect a similar story here in terms of heat stress. The reality is that the maze models are not at the, this is kind of one of the surprising things to me, is the maze models are not quite as far along as the Sorgut models are. I mean, maybe I've become enamored with the Australian sort of models, but the maze models, we haven't incorporated these effects into maze models as well, and we haven't really characterized the genetic variability. But maybe most importantly, the frequency of exposure to these temperatures is not as high as it is in Australia. So I think, in my mind, and the water stress effects of extreme heat in the 30 degrees and above are dominating the effects. And one reason we think that is because we can run models in the U.S. without any of these heat stress effects, and we can pretty much reproduce exactly the observed relationships between extreme heat and yield, which implies that the main mechanism driving that observed relationship is the water stress, which is in the model, not the heat stress, which is not in the model. So we think about how do you adapt to that increased water stress. And there's lots of possibilities out there. So in terms of the fight sort of strategies, the tolerance sort of strategies, as I said before, you could try to do things like cap the maximum transpiration rates of crops. That seems to be effective and one of the things underpinning a lot of the recent drought tolerant seeds. The problem with that, as I said before, is not so much that it isn't good. It's just that if you do that, the rational response of the farmer is to basically expose the plant to more and more drought stress. So it is in some ways equally good in current climate as future climate. Therefore, it's not really effectively reducing kind of the impacts of extreme heat. In other words, you can take advantage of that. If you weren't being exposed to higher and higher evaporation pressures, you could take advantage of that by increasing density and higher yield. So you still have this loss if you compare more extreme heat to less extreme heat. Not to say it's not a useful trait, but it's not one that's going to really reduce effectively the impacts. Whereas like the heat stress effects, as I said, there's genetic variability for that doesn't really have a whole lot of other uses if you don't see the increase in extreme heat. So what we do in the case of the U.S. is we thought a lot about strategies in general, but in particular about the escape mechanism and what's the possibilities for escaping the most extreme heat of the summer. And you can see in this is just an example of the phenology of the corn system with the peak of the corn season, and particularly the most sensitive time, as many of you know, coinciding with the hottest part of the year. This just shows temperatures over the year. In contrast, if you look at a winter wheat, summer soy double crop system, you get the wheat harvested, you start the soybean, but the soybean's not really peaking and sensitive until after you've passed the hottest part of the year. So there is some rationale for these double crop systems. So the challenges, a few challenges with these double crop systems, but one of them is simply that getting these two crops in is difficult because you, first of all, need the temperature regime. You need the frost to be far enough apart. You also need the water to be able to do it. But increasingly, it seems like this could be an option as the frost recedes. So what we've looked at is, first of all, historically, what's been the trend in double cropping. And this shows you basically the percent of double cropping that's occurring in areas that were formerly or even still what we would define as frost constrained. In other words, they have a hard frost on both sides of the season. It's not like, you know, Florida. And increasingly, we're seeing double cropping there relative to the rest of the country, indicating that the suitability of this crop, the attractiveness to farmers is going up even more than it is in the other parts of the country where you would expect, like, say, if prices for certain crops are going up, it would be going up everywhere. But this is preferentially going up in these cooler areas. Then what we did is we built a simple model of phenology to see how many seasons and in each location can you fit in a wheat-soy crop before the soy would see a frost preceding maturity. So that would be kind of the definition of can you fit in this double crop. And we've looked at that. This isn't the best graphic. I'll blame it on my graduate student, I guess. But I'll also give him all the credit, but blame him for this tough-to-read figure here, which is the probability of survival of these systems. So blue being good, you can see it shifts from what it is currently to one where the suitability is reaching well into the heart of the corn belt, what we have right now, by the end of the century. And this is under two emission scenarios, a lower emission and a higher emission scenario. So we're already seeing this occur. We can see that the predicted rate of suitability increase matches pretty well the rate of increase that we see. And so this is, you know, potentially an effective way of avoiding extreme heat altogether by switching cropping systems. There's still a lot of questions, though, about sort of what is the net effect, then you're taking out a very productive corn crop, you're putting in a wheat and a soybean crop. From a farmer perspective, is that profitable enough? Is it as profitable to incentivize it? Well, it seems to be that, you know, there's enough incentive here to be driving the increase. And then as you continue going out into the future, will that be the case, or at some point do people get pulled back to corn because you need to produce a certain level of corn? So those are just two examples. I think the main points to take away is that, you know, be careful in terms of how you think about extreme heat. I find that in my conversations with all sorts of people in agriculture, there is this tendency to just think about pollination and sort of direct damage of very high temperatures that is very visible. That is one end of the spectrum that's certainly important and more common than it used to be. But extreme heat can do all sorts of other things before you get to that point. So as we think about adaptation, it's not just about the example I gave, which is reducing grain set, but it's things about improving the tolerance improving the water stress performance of the crops, increasing potentially the pest and disease resistance as those things start to scale up with high temperatures. But I would say that in general, we don't actually have a very good idea of the relative merits of these different approaches. And it will depend on where you are. It'll depend on the crops you're growing. It'll depend on the baseline temperatures. How close are you to these different triggers? And then finally, I think that even when it does seem to work, it generally speaking does not get you back to where you would have been without the climate change. So we have to think about the counterfactual without climate change, not just the sort of with climate change and without this innovation versus with this climate change and without the innovation, with the innovation, we have to also think with and without the climate change. I didn't say that clearly at all, but my experience has been, you know, and Mark can maybe comment on this, but my experience has been when you're talking to people outside of the agricultural community and you talk about adaptation, if you're not thinking with and without climate change as sort of your counterfactual, it can easily get confused and they are thinking, okay, well, of course you're going to adapt, so give us the impacts that when you're adapted. But oftentimes the way we're calculating those things, I think, is not the right counterfactual. We're just comparing with climate change without the technology, with climate change with the technology, and that's not the right comparison if you're thinking about adaptation in the climate change sense. So I'll stop there so we have time for questions. Thanks.